Good morning, everyone. It is 9 a.m. on November 15th, 2022, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County Community Board of Commissioners. I'm Toni Olson, Board President. We will now recess the meet. Oh, is she on? We're having technical difficulties.
I think she may be on under, that's Commissioner Wolf.
Commissioner Wolf, can you hear us?
Ask her to dial star nine.
Have you dialed star nine to come in via the telephone? Well, I do suggest, clerk, that we.
She's on there. Somebody keeps, we just need to unmute her. She's on there.
But I do want to make sure that we have the ability for interaction.
Okay. I'm here.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. We have with us Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, Vice President, who is joining us virtually or telephonically. Are you on the phone?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sid Logan, Board Secretary. Guy Payne, Assistant General Manager, Distribution and Engineering Services. Jeff Kallstrom, Interim General Counsel. Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director. Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board. Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board. And Frank Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please remember to mute your electronic devices during the meeting. This session is for the board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. Guy, I will turn it over to you.
Good morning. We'll start out with our legislative. This is questions only. Do we have any legislative questions this morning? If there are no questions, we will move on to our next section. We've got Mark Fleury and Aaron Janisco this morning going to give us a storm update on the recent windstorm.
Morning, Commissioners.
Morning.
My name is Mark Fleury. I'm the Senior Manager of System Operations and Engineering at the district, and here with me is Aaron Janisco. He's the Senior Manager of Regional Design and Construction Services. I also want to recognize Paul Kiss, who's with us today. He's the Operations Superintendent. He plays a very big role during storm restoration, so I'm glad to have Paul here today. So we're here to talk about the storm event that started on November 4th. We'll run through a number of items today to include the weather forecast and the preparation that we were able to do, what the impacts of the storm were, the initial restoration actions that we took, mutual aid assistance that we received, which was wonderful, overall damage assessment, the role that safety, security, and emergency management played, final results, and then we'll also talk about what our next steps and plans for the next big storm will be. And also, because supply chain,
not another one like this.
Supply chain, I know, has been a big area of interest for the commission as well, so we'll touch on that. So we were watching the storm for the week leading up to Friday, November the 4th. We watched National Weather Service, and their weather models are generally very accurate. They were predicting for the 4th and the 5th gusty winds, but on the order of 40 miles an hour, which generally is about the threshold where we think we're gonna get some damage in the system. We ended up with gusts on the order of 70 to 80 miles an hour in North Stanwood and on Canoe Island. We've got weather stations that are substations that can measure the gusts, so we get pretty accurate information. So although we knew weather was going to hit and we were prepared for it, we just had no idea it was going to be of this order of magnitude. So Friday morning, well in advance of the storm, we notified district field employees that we were going to be doing an all-hands call at 10 p.m. that night. The weather was expected to hit right around 10 p.m., and indeed it did. It ran to about 2 a.m. in the morning, so it blew for about 4 hours. We did our all-hands call out at 10 p.m. on November 4th. And then we began contacting mutual aid crews about 4 hours after the all-hands call-out. And one note about mutual aid crews, while they're very generous with their time and their resources, they of course want to stay in their own areas and make sure they understand the full estimation of their damage before they commit to come to Snohomish PD. In terms of impacts, early Saturday morning, we were able to assess the total damage. We had over 100 breaker outages. Total throughout the storm, we had about 250,000 customers without power. Wind gusts exceeded 80 miles an hour on Camino Island. And generally, to characterize the damage, it was just severe tree damage, in part because we had a lot of leaves still on the trees, so heavy foliage. We had several severe drought summers, so that impacted the health and well-being of the trees. And also the soil conditions were saturated, which with a shallow root structure generator can lend to tree toppling. We often have storms that are isolated either on Camino Island or East County or up in the Darrington area. This was widespread. It was across our entire service territory. In fact, in North Everett, we had thousands of customers out, which is a rarity for us. So the initial actions that we took early Saturday morning, we declared an emergency. That allows us some flexibility in terms of mutual aid and contracting. We had 17 district line crews and 15 service crews that were deployed as soon as the weather allowed them to safely leave the operations center. As I noted on a previous slide, mutual aid crews were requested, and the very first mutual aid crews arrived around midday on Saturday the 5th. So that was about 12 hours into the storm. Here's a list of all the participants, and we're very grateful for the crews they sent and the time they put in to help get our customers back into power. You can see it's quite a list. These contractors and PUDs. In terms of our damage assessment, the restoration priorities that we use, there's several here listed, but it's based on a number of key considerations, and it's very fluid. We look at transmission and breaker outages first because that allows us to restore the maximum amount of customers at a single time. So the most bang for your buck, per se. We also look at critical customers. We start with hospitals. We look at fire stations, police stations, schools. Because the storm hit on a Friday night, we had a lot of interest on Sunday as to whether or not there'd be school in session on Monday. We got all schools restored by Tuesday morning, so they just missed the one day, much to the chagrin of a lot of school students. and we also look at customer count and location. We don't want to send folks from Coupon Island to Darrington, so we look at proximity to the jobs. Weather and road conditions, if we've got icy roads, we want to keep crews kind of working in a general area so they're not driving a bunch of miles on icy roads. We also look at crew rest times. Believe it or not, our initial deployment of crews, they work for 40 hours straight. And we don't want to give them a large job 2 hours before they're going to go for a meal or go down on rest. So that's another factor we take into account. And then also, we'll have a job that's a daylight only job or a walk-in job where they have to climb a pole. We reserve those for daylight, so they wouldn't be a priority in the evening hours.
So back on that slide, how able are we to get a picture of the entire service area as far as damage? I mean, within a few hours, do we have a general, a pretty good sense of what the damage is, or are you just constantly finding more damage as you get into things?
So our systems identify where there's a problem and it predicts to a device. So if we have a number of customers, it would predict up to a fuse or to a transformer, but we don't know what the cause was.
Okay.
We don't know whether it was a tree in the line or just a branch that hit the line. So we have to actually send our servicemen out to be first responders and assess what the problem is. And we were looking at, we had over 1,100 incidents to look at, and so we were assessing throughout the storm. The key is just to stay ahead of our crews and then look for those areas where we have pockets of the most customers are out. So if we had 1,000 customers out, we would deploy a serviceman to that area,
right,
to do his first responder work, and then create a crew job.
A follow-up to that question. My memory may be bad, but haven't we in the past used a drone or had a flyover when we have had this kind of damage to get an overall assessment?
We have used a helicopter in the past for cross-country transmission right-of-ways that are hard to get to.
Okay.
We have been using drones for blue sky day inspections on those transmission corridors and have caught a number of issues that we've addressed, but not for storm damage assessment yet.
Probably when the wind's blowing, that's not a very good idea to send a drone out.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, just so it has been done in the past.
It has.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm going to hand it over to Aaron now. He's going to talk a little bit about our safety record during the storm and some of the next steps.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Janesco, Snohomish County PD, Regional Design and Construction Services Senior Manager. As you can see on this slide here, the number one stat that we are most proud of is we went through this entire storm, both with our internal crews as well as mutual aid and contract, with absolutely zero injuries to our knowledge. I was going to play you an audio today. We couldn't get it to work. But a big part of line work is safety. There's a lot of processes in place. It's a very methodical way of doing work. And I compare it similar to air traffic control. That's what our energy control center is. You think of air traffic control and everything that they're managing to keep an airport safe, with obviously airplanes coming in. It's very similar to our energy control dispatchers, as they're working with our crews in the field. When our folks go into the field, they have to call in, and there's what we call a clearance process. And it's a series of repeating back and forth what the work is. It's a lockout, tagout type process. And it does take time, but it's there for a reason, to keep folks safe. And the last thing we want is anyone to ever get hurt or worse. One other thing I wanted to mention as we go through here, all of these pictures on the backgrounds are all from last week during the storm. So they weren't just made up. So pretty cool pictures. This, you talk about the walk-in earlier. That one on the right was a walk-in on Camano Island. It was a concrete pole, which is pretty rare in our system. We had to install pegs on the sides to climb up, which we don't do very often, but pretty cool pick. So, and that was a daylight walk-in one there. So,
you know, that's phenomenal that we've got no injuries. I mean, when you think of the circumstances, the way trees pile up like bits poured out of a box, I can't imagine. That's wonderful.
You think of all the chainsaws that ran last week, cutting up just to get to our power lines and make repairs, and yes, it's pretty remarkable. Not going. Here we go. So our safety department, I wanted to throw some stats up here real quick. Heavily involved. They were out throughout the entire storm, and truly do think it's making a difference. So they visited every crew we had out there, and in some cases multiple times, along with house fires, other accidents in the field. We had to dig in from a contractor. As you can see, it goes on and on. They're also very involved. When we onboard our contractors and mutual aid, it's a very thorough process, which Paul also owns that piece along with safety. And we go through about a half an hour onboarding of how our system works, what we expect from our folks. We give them a grounding kit to make sure everything they have is out there to be successful on how we do work here, and we're not going to cut corners. Again, Rob Beiser's group provided extra security for us, you know, along with all the mutual aid and contractors. We're putting them up in hotels, and security is a big piece. There's been a lot of theft, as we all hear about, and those trucks are a big easy target with all the materials they have on them. So Rob's group supported very well. And then the other pieces are deeply embedded in emergency management down with DEM, and those groups across the county. And so we're all intertwined working together. So some stats I'm going to share in the next slide, kind of how we've compared in the past. But for this storm, we had 70 poles that were replaced, 618 cutouts, which is the fuse. Oftentimes you hear that the transformer blew up. It's actually the fuse that blew. 618 of those, 90 transformers. We had over 750 crew jobs. That's a job that requires a person of four people or more to complete that work. And I want to say, apples to apples, this storm probably had more damage than I've ever seen in 23 years, job per job. For example, we had a job on the Mountain Loop Highway. Well, it wasn't one job. There was probably 10 or 15 jobs out there because there's just stuff down. We just gave a crew that line and said, go fix it all. So just a tremendous amount of work that was done. Again, Mark mentioned earlier the 1,100 service crew jobs that were fielded. Our warehouse does amazing support, 250 deliveries in the field. And I think that next one, 10,259 wire splices were issued out in 7 days last week. Just an amazing amount of wire that was on the ground that had to be put back up. And then in terms of new wire to replace damaged wire, about 27 miles of wire was put up. And that's just replaced. That doesn't include what we actually put back up that was existing.
So what does that mean, it needed to be replaced? Does that mean it was damaged in so many places that it would be ridiculous to splice it every few feet, or what does that mean?
If you drive down the road some in heavily treated areas, sometimes you'll see wire, and you see these what we call them bumps or splices, and you'll see them in a line. Well, oftentimes a crew will cut a section out and just replace that section, or if it's been driven over or it's frayed, so cut out the bad spots to make the system whole. So some stats from the past, we pulled August of 2015, as well as November that year. We had two big windstorms, which are a real fair comparison to this last week. Things to note, like I say, the number of crew jobs, you can see where we were at this last week. You look at the mutual aid response that we had, we kept it at 30 last week. We felt that that was about the right number. It gets to a point where you could almost have too many in the field. And we gotta be very, very careful about that. People tripping over each other. Our system is, we have an awesome electric system. The good news is it's loop fed. We do a lot of sectionalizing and switching, but with that, you have to be very careful. And so 30 was about the right number, and it worked really well. I mentioned the mileage on wire. You can see 13 miles, 22 miles, and then you know last week at 27 miles. Number of poles, pretty consistent in August of 2015 versus last week. Transformers, again, very similar. But again, in about the same amount of time, we did more with less. And I think that better processes, higher morale, really just the teamwork, they spoke for itself. Another, I guess I would call it data point that I'm proud of, is at the end of a storm when I'm seeing our crews come in and they're still smiling, that tells me morale's up. That's important to me, and our folks did an amazing job. So some of our next steps, we're gonna take this storm, we're gonna do two things with it. We know we can always be better. There's always little things, sometimes big things, that we can figure out to improve on, strategy, whatnot. We're gonna do individual focus groups, and then we're gonna bring those groups together to a larger after action review and really learn from that. The second piece we're gonna do is, this is one of the biggest ever we've had, but what if something twice this big hits? And what's gonna be our strategy around something of mass destruction? And so we're gonna take that and develop a bigger plan, because it may look different. So we're gonna bring a lot of groups together to have that conversation and formulate that. And we're also gonna work closely with our emergency management group as well, because it could be a whole new level. And then just some supply chain stuff. Again, I mentioned all the wire that was either replaced or put on the ground. In terms of wire, we're in good shape. The splices were becoming a little bit low. Not too much to worry about, we were watching. We did reach out to a couple neighboring utilities. They had some that they sent us just as a backup. We also reached out to our vendor, and due to emergency, they put us as a high priority at the top of the list. So overall, we're in good shape. Kind of a note, a lot of your supply chain issues that we have all faced across the utility world primarily have been underground type stuff. So it hasn't really been a factor in terms of storm. Also, in terms of overhead transformers, a lot of utilities in the south, because of hurricanes, they struggle with that. We're in really good shape when it comes to our overhead transformers. So overall, we feel really good where we're at. And through other relationships, we're networking very well with utilities across the region. For example, Avista, way back months ago, we were low on some terminations and they reached out and gave us a bunch. Well, in return, they became low and we just returned the favor a few weeks ago. And Paul Kissel also has been a very big part of that through his connections across the area. The last thing I would mention, again, around relationships, you saw the overwhelming positive response from all the utilities. We recently, 2 weeks ago, hosted the East-West Mutual Aid Conference, which happens three times a year. And so what timing? We hosted it for a week, and the next week we got hit with a storm. So, but it paid off, and it's a great organization. So
the transformer shortages that we're dealing with aren't the pole transformers. They're the ones that are in the boxes on the ground.
A lot of the pad mounts, yeah. And we were able to work with the manufacturer to reprioritize which ones, because normally they just have a, you know, an assembly line, right? And they're being produced. Well, we're able to work with them to identify the sizes that we needed most, and they were able to put those in those slots for us to be built. So that's worked out well, and we're in a lot better place. And then the underground wire was also a big one for a while, but just all the big construction we have going on, Amazon, for example, it took a lot of big wire. We reached out, utility in Colorado helped us out. And so that's another good example. And in the meantime, we have good orders in place, and we're in good shape.
Are we playing video or not?
Should I ask my question?
Take questions.
Oh, just a couple of questions. Now I understand in terms of advance notice of how severe the weather was going to be, because I thought to myself sitting at home in the cold that I was surprised that, you know, when we believe we're going to have a storm that will cause damage, you folks usually lock up mutual aid crews ahead of time, and we may have to pay them if we don't need them. That didn't happen this time. However, I now understand that it was because the advance notice of the weather didn't it was like 40 mile an hour winds, and then all of a sudden it went up to 70. So that answers my question. Thank you.
Yeah, also I would note, if you were to look on a map and look at our service territory and how the wind hit, we normally see winds kind of out of the southwest that come through our territory. This wind came straight out of the west, and we were right in the bullseye. That rarely happens here, which I think is the reason for the magnitude. But to your point on mutual aid, 40 miles an hour, we would not normally.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The other things that were happening across the area, Avista had a potential storm warning going on. They were securing resources. We did reach out. So that night, the wind started at 10 p.m. Friday night, roughly. And at midnight, Mark and I were on the phone, and we pulled the trigger on mutual aid. We were already calling our east-west representatives, and we had them en route.
Okay.
So that was a pretty quick trigger to pull.
I think in the past, my question has been answered, that weather predictions were not 70 mile an hour winds, and that's why we didn't block them up early. So
one other thing that we do typically each year, and it's we're out to contract right now on a packet of what we call bad order pulls, and we do that strategically because in that contract, whoever receives the award, in that contract we have rights to them first during storm season while they're working on our property, and that's just a strategy to have more resources when needed. And that contract's out right now, and it's expired, or it closes this Friday, so we'll be awarding that very soon.
Let's see what else. I'm assuming that you've got a lot of cleanup work to do, that the crews are not going to have any relief for quite some time.
I've had talks with servicemen. We've never seen so many services to houses down as we did in this storm, let alone all the other construction. But right now, electricians are busy trying to get things fixed so we can come back and reconnect.
Okay.
That's been another big piece for sure.
And my final one is...
Hello?
Advanced meters and smart grid. How might that have impacted?
Oh.
I'm just asking the question.
Yeah, can't come soon enough.
Yeah, I know. Thank
you. I've got a few questions. First couple really.
I have a question.
Yes, Commissioner Wolf.
Hello. Oh, thank you. I just have one question. First of all, I do understand the complexity of this storm, having grown up in hurricane country. I just have one question. A lot of people have raised the question about, it seems very spotty. Everybody around me, even close to me, even in my own apartment building, have power, but I do not. So it seems that this is different, maybe, in terms of being more spotty. Is there any explanation for that, or how are you investigating how that could have happened?
Well, every outage is different. Some outages, a limb could have came down and hit the transformer and blew that fuse, only affecting one customer. Other times, the main feeder on a circuit is out and you're affecting 1,500 customers. Again, a storm like this, you go and the feeder comes down, there's other things behind that with the more trees coming down and on and on and on to when we re-energize, we're gonna pick up as many as we can, but it may not be everybody. There may be more individual jobs going on, so.
Eric, I think the,
okay.
The question she's asking, I can paraphrase, is I think there's sort of a lack of understanding how in a neighborhood, houses that are next to each other, maybe on different circuits, and a circuit could be out, or can you talk about that a little bit?
There can be. Again, I mentioned our system is what I call very loop fed. And so at some point, our system protection engineers in planning, they make decisions based on load and whatnot, where they decide who's on which circuit, right? Sometimes that's luck of the draw. There's reasons for it. It's typically load, you know, wire size and comparing all that. And just happens to be, you know, where you're at. That does happen.
Yeah. I had a couple of questions. Are we gonna be able to get FEMA dollars? And I didn't hear if the governor ever declared an emergency. Is that what it takes?
I didn't hear from the governor, but I believe we will go after FEMA reimbursement. Okay. And we are, whether it's how we're charging our time to just documenting everything through years of history and learning, you know, what they're looking for. That's been something that's, you know, prevalent in what we're doing to make sure we're doing it accurately.
And the other is just more of a comment, and I hope that you guys take this to heart, not a criticism, when it's time to look at it when everyone slept well and looking backwards. But I noticed that our public seemed to react different to this storm. And I think there was a couple of things. I think they didn't understand the magnitude because the magnitude was so widespread. But for the first time more than ever, I felt just people being angry that we couldn't tell them potentially when they're gonna be restored. No, not necessarily complaining they weren't restored, although they'd love to be restored, but just, I think that expectation is just, it just felt to me, if the storm felt different. And we did a great job of getting the word out and advising people, but I think that one, you know, we suspend the ETRs and I can understand why, and obviously Connect Up will be hugely helpful with all that, you know, they can text people or, but I just felt that there's a new expectation.
It's a challenge, no doubt about it.
Yeah, a huge challenge.
Actually have a meeting today on that outage communication piece, ironically.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, at the water, it also was a sign as we're pretty reliable. They're not used to this.
We're pretty reliable. I think we also have people move to our service territory that come from places that don't, you know, they don't have outages. Now they're in the evergreen state. The trees come down and they don't understand why all the power is not underground. And those are huge challenges to try to communicate that. But I mean, you know, higher expectations will make us better. We already have high expectations for ourselves. But we just felt different this time.
I would agree.
Yeah. More criticism than we had more work to do. So
yep.
Yeah. But I tell you what, phenomenal work. I'm incredibly impressed that we didn't have any injuries. I don't know how that's possible. I'm trying to chainsaw a tree out of my backyard and not hurt myself. So I can only imagine, you know, the complexity and the situations that groups found themselves.
Oh, I just say I'm very proud of the effort. A lot of moving parts, a lot going on, and our folks really did rise to the occasion. I get some of the frustrations out there, but it's a journey. We're always working to get better, and we'll just keep after it. So,
I have a question about mutual aid, if I may.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. When we have so many people coming in to help us, people and trucks and so forth, how are those people remunerated for their time and expenses, and how does that happen? What is that process?
We have several things in place. So with the East West Mutual Aid, which are the public utilities across the state, we have contracts and agreements in place. So yes, they are compensated for that. With our private contractors, we typically around August, September, we send out a memorandum and they respond back with their contract pricing. And then we have a team that reviews all of that, as well as we make sure that they're pre-qualified to do the type of work, because there's a lot of different type of work in a utility, you can imagine. And so there's reference
right.
check and whatnot, so.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, that's interesting. Thank you.
Now, that's something under pre-qual. I never even thought that that would be necessary, but it is.
Yeah, well, again, safety starts with safety, and
we
reach out to utilities all over asking for reference checks and how did this company work, whether we want them on our property.
So. Yeah. Well, I do appreciate you clarifying some of the questions I had.
Absolutely.
My picture is very dated, so of what a storm response is, so helped me quite a bit.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Logan, I interrupted you a short while ago, and my apologies.
Oh, that's okay. Maybe it was.
Oh, well, then I'll begin.
I would like to just add a little bit of context. We do an after-action review after every single storm, and so it's a really continual improvement process. And then we did an actual CI initiative on storm alone throughout the summer and had the right cross-functional people just figuring out how to take the bottlenecks out, identify any gaps, streamline the processes. Our mutual aid crews that were coming in kept making comments that this was the most organized storm they'd ever worked, and they would come work here at any time. Our folks did a phenomenal job. The intensity, the persistence throughout the entire storm. With a storm this magnitude, we're always going to have more learning opportunities. But it was like a well-oiled machine. I could not. I've worked a lot of storms, you know, in different states, Florida, California, and the process is here so streamlined. This storm in another utility that would be less prepared may go on for a couple of weeks. I think our folks just did absolute phenomenal jobs. And everybody knows their role. We have a whole storm team, and everybody knows just what their role is before a storm hits. So kudos to our folks at the PUD. I wished everyone in the public could see how hard they work and how much they care. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, I received a lot of calls. But after letting them vent and having some background, they began to understand. 90% of them said, I understand now. And it kind of relieved their apprehension down to here. But also, I just wanted Guy to expand on that. Major storm, it reverberates throughout the organization. You know, from gathering information to pay all those bills for contractors, the support folks, stores, transportation, engineering. So that team thing is really almost utility.
Absolutely.
That's impressive when you think about how we can help manage and make efficient the outside crews. I think it's challenging enough to deal with it for our own, you know, an all hands effort to get things done, but then to integrate folks that don't normally work with us, that's phenomenal. And only can help us restore things quicker. Thank you very much.
Any more questions, commissioners?
No, thank you for all your hard work.
I think Allison's going to share a little video from this was sent in to us to our corporate communications group from a customer on Camino Island, which I thought was a pretty touching way to end. So thank you.
Hey, PUD, my name is Lindsay Thomas, and I live in the Latham Arrowhead part of Camino Island. My power just came on, and I jumped in the car to try and find the crew that helped us out, just to go and thank you all. My 92-year-old great aunt on an oxygen machine also thanks you all profusely and wanted me to pass that along. I'm sorry that I couldn't actually find the group that put on my power, because as soon as they put it on, they must have moved on to take care of the next group of folks. Thank you guys and girls, whoever, all of you, for leaving your families, coming to a different county, or just being up at night in your own county, making sure that we were able to get our power back and have everything in order. I'm looking at a crew now, actually, near the northernmost elementary on Kamano Island, and I see another crew working out there. So thank you again for everything you guys have done. Sorry I couldn't thank you in person, but this is the next best thing. Good luck with everything else you're doing out there. Stay warm, stay safe, and know that we're all grateful.
That was great. That was great.
Because Kamano was one of the ones that were in Three Point, were out.
Yeah. And I saw that there's a coffee, there's a coffee thing that kept taking coffee out to people on Kamano and then posting social media.
Yeah, the community of Kamano came together and they donated a ton of money to a coffee stand as well as a bakery.
Yeah.
And then reached out to us to let those folks know to stop by if they were coming and going. And you're right, Kamano Island was a war zone.
Yeah.
It got, and then also the Priest Point area was destructive. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron, Mark. Next, we have Beth Haskin with the Dish Wireless LLC Master License Agreement.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Beth Haskin, Joint Use and Permits Administrator in the Joint Use Department here at the district. This morning, I'm presenting on the Dish Wireless LLC Master License Agreement. The purpose of this presentation this morning is to communicate the request from Dish Wireless LLC, which I'll refer to as Dish, to enter into a Master License Agreement, which I'll refer to as MLA, with the district for their wireless antenna attachments on district properties and facilities. The goal is to obtain board approval of the Dish MLA at the next commission meeting on December 6th. There we go. For a foundation, MLA is an overall agreement that's required for all wireless type antenna attachments on district facilities or within our properties. It's required to be in place before the district will enter into a site acknowledgement agreement with the party. It's the umbrella that gives them the approval to apply for a site license acknowledgement, which we'll call it SLA. SLA is site specific. It goes through an application process. It's reviewed by relevant departments within the district. The ultimate approval for the SLA is with our department manager, Mo Matthews. An annual fee for the wireless attachment is addressed within the SLA. In January, Dish contacted us about entering into an agreement. We provided the MLA and SLA templates for their review. In June, they came back to us with some comments and questions, which we addressed through our legal department. And by August, we were in agreement and reached out to get on your calendar. Next steps is a recommendation for board approval of the Dish MLA, the next meeting on December 6th. Any questions?
Is Dish located in one part of our county, or is that countywide?
They're
countywide.
At this point, we don't have any Dish facilities.
Oh, all right.
Infrastructure.
That's so this they're focusing on the county, though, not just some one year.
At this point, they've recognized there's three sites initially that they are interested in applying for.
I'm curious what kind of I think they're a satellite company, so I'm curious what kind of infrastructure they want to put on our homes or facilities.
It's our understanding it is wireless antennas, similar to other carriers that we have within our territory.
Okay.
We won't get into the actual specific equipment until we get into the SLA process. So this is kind of the umbrella.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioners, do we have any other questions? Hearing none?
No.
Thank you. Commissioner Wolf?
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, Commissioner Logan's question was mine too. I'm not familiar with DISH. Oh, pardon me. Other than with the satellites, but I think the answer was that they have other things, but we don't know yet what they are. Is that right?
That's correct. We don't know the specific specs for the equipment as of yet.
Okay. I think we can assume they're not going to put a satellite dish on our pole.
I think that's a safe assumption. They indicated.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Beth. Next, we have Nick Johnston, the Snow 911 communication site license agreement.
Thank you. My name is Nick Johnston. I'm the telecommunications manager here at the district. And today I'm here to talk about our agreement with Snow 911 for shared space in their facilities. So the purpose today is to go over the communication site co-location agreement that will allow us to continue co-locating in their facilities. And then second, to obtain approval for a memorandum of understanding to pay back rent. So we'll go into a little bit of the background here. Snohomish County 911 operates a land mobile radio system similar to ours in the district. Theirs is for their 911 and for first responders. Ours is for a utility district. In managing a land mobile radio system, we end up at similar sites, which is why we lease to them and they lease to us. Today, we're focusing on our leased area from their equipment. It started back in 2005, and we leased space in the city of Mount Lake Terrace owned facility. And we have some information up here about the existing lease. It was a 5-year term with 2 years renewal. In addition to that, we added another 5 years in 2020. Should have brought us up to 2025. We'll get into that a little bit later here. In 2007, we added the Fraley Mountain site, which is just north of Oso and allows us better coverage in the Oso area, Darrington, and also the eastern areas of East Arlington. We'll note that this is significantly higher than the Mount Lake Terrace site because it's a mountaintop site and they provide backup power to us. It's a remote area and one of our more difficult ones to get to. So to get fuel up there and things like that is a little bit more difficult. We've had a really good relationship over the years and we continue that. In 2019, what used to be known as SERS, or Snohomish Emergency Radio System, merged with Snohomish County 911 under the Snohomish County 911, what we refer to as Snow 911. And then in January of 2021, our purchase order that we used to pay the rent to Snow 911 expired. And we were doing our research to make sure that we were okay to pull another PO. We realized that we did not have a fully executed contract. So we were unable to pull a PO and unable to pay them. We reached out to Snow 911 and explained the difficulties. They looked through their records and didn't have a fully executed copy as well. We also reached out to the city of Mount Lake Terrace and they as well did not have a fully executed copy. So ever since then, we've been working hard to establish a new agreement. Snow 911, similar to the district, we're not in business to lease space to people as far as telecom is concerned. So it's a bit of a, we don't have processes or procedures set up to just come up with this stuff. And it's great that Beth is actually here to introduce our MLA and SLA system. That worked so well, they actually copied that and they're using our MLA and our SLA for a lease agreement. So it kind of helped the process. It's still a process. So we had the intent of paying back rent this entire time, but we just were unable to do it because we didn't have that fully executed contract. On a side note, in 2022, we started building out our AMI system. And again, mountaintop sites or centrally located sites are beneficial for land mobile radio, also in great locations for AMI, micro sites, base station sites. So in this process, we added the new equipment, or the ability to add the equipment and those sites to the agreement. So the new agreement, like I mentioned, they use our MLA template or master license agreement and the site license acknowledgement template. And they renamed it to communication site co-location lease agreement. And and that will allow us to continue our co-location with them and contains all of the overarching agreement that apply to all sites. And then we also added the specific site license acknowledgement for Rayleigh and for Mount Lake Terrace. It's a little bit different cost just to modernize the account structure as well as adding our AMI equipment. It's within line with what we charge them for our sites as well. And then as far as the memorandum of understanding, it basically outlines how much we owe the city of Mount Lake Terrace in back rent, and then also Snow 911. It basically states that if we don't pay it by January, that they can back out of this MLA and salary agreement. But like I mentioned, we fully intend to pay them. We need the method in place, and that's what we're here today to ask or to present those two agreements, and then later we'll come back on December 6th to ask for your consideration for a resolution approving our ability to sign those agreements.
Commissioner Wolf, do you have any questions?
No, thank you very much.
Commissioner Logan?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your time.
Commissioner Olson, you know I got to have a question.
Sure.
I may have missed it in here. Will the term of these be 5 years with renewable or
yes.
What? They'll be 5 years with renewable. Okay.
The MLA, and we'll have to take a look at it, but we extended that to be a longer term. So that we don't have to go through that, but the SLAs will be in line with what we have today.
So are there increases automatically?
Yes, year it's 5%, just like the original.
Okay, 5, but so there's logged in. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Next, we have Jeff Feinberg with the Grants to Utilities for Residential Customer Arrears. He's with us virtually.
Yeah. Hi, good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Sorry that I can't be there in person. I'm currently in Washington, D.C. at the Behavior, Energy, and Climate Change Conference. I was sitting on a panel and getting to share a little bit about some of our energy efficiency customer programs at the conference. But today, I am back to just talk with you a little bit and give you some more details around what we discussed 2 weeks ago whenever I was with you. And you'll recall the presentation 2 weeks ago was kind of just an overview of this work that had been ongoing based on the legislature's budget proviso for $100 million for customer arrearages. And then today we're going to talk a little bit about what that will specifically mean for our customers and how we plan to prioritize and use these funds. And so I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to control the screen because I'm on an iPad. So I don't know, Morgan or Allison, if one of you might be able to advance the slides for me.
We can do that for you.
Thank you. Oh, and I should have announced my name is Jeff Feinberg, Senior Manager of Energy Efficiency and Customer Innovations. Thank you. So we can go to the next slide. So again, this morning, we're going to update the different process steps involved in this process. We're going to clarify some of the rules and expectations, and we're going to discuss our specific allocation amount that Commerce has given us up to this point, and then set expectations around all the different steps. And I guess what I want to say is, this is one of those things that it's, we're excited to be able to give you this update, and rules are still under development as we speak. And so there's times where I'm going to share some specifics, but also have some caveats and some qualifiers. And that is not to be elusive, but it's just to kind of give us the space we need to continue to work things out with Commerce as these rules around this program continue to develop in real time. Next slide, please. All right, so some of the process steps completed. We've created an eligible customer dashboard, and we've developed the necessary analytics so that we can prioritize what customers might be eligible. So you'll recall whenever I discussed this last week that all LIHEAP, LIHEAP customers, LIHWAP customers, and customers that have participated in ratepayer-funded assistance programs have been deemed eligible according to this allocation. And so what we did is we worked with analytics team, and we are forever in debt to Chris Bridge and his team, and specifically Sam Pell, because she has worked tirelessly with me at building a dashboard of all customers that we believe to be eligible. And it's got a ton of different really useful filters so that basically we've been working on this for months so that we were ready once we got our allocation so that we can kind of try a bunch of different filters to prioritize customers and to figure out how to leverage these funds in a really equitable way to serve as many customers as possible. And so we've got this excellent dashboard that's been built. And some of the tools that we're going to use and some of the variables that Commerce is allowing for us to prioritize are here on the slide. But we have LIHEAP and LIWAP participation. We have income level, age of balance, largest balance. And all of this is kind of based on arrearages that have been accrued between March of 2020 and December of 2021. And so we've got this tool built. It's ready to go. And we're able to start leveraging it. Customer service has also been really helpful at trying to help us break it after Sam built it so that we could make sure that it was effective and that there weren't any gaps in the data and in the reporting. And it's so that's good to go. Next slide, please.
Jeff, may I ask a question before you go to the next slide?
Of course.
What does it mean, final? Does it finalize, is that for different reasons or generally the main reason would be what?
What word?
It says final. I think it means finalized.
It means final build. So some customers, if they would have closed their accounts during the period, we still wanted to make sure that they were here in the database because they might still be eligible for these funds even if they closed their account.
Okay.
And
thank
so,
you.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that we cast a really, really wide net based on the rules that we're developing with Commerce of, okay, what are all the different programs that might make a customer eligible? And then we've pulled all of those customers with a lot of other data points specific to those customers into this dashboard so that we've kind of got the master list of customers we believe will be eligible. And then we can kind of filter accordingly based on the rules as they continue to develop. That makes sense.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right, next slide. So the big news, and this has even changed since we put this slide deck together, but we've conditionally received up to actually $10,009,000 and some change for our customers. And the reason I say conditionally received is that is the allocation amount of the 100 million that has been set aside for Snohomish County PUD customers. We now will continue to work with Commerce on these prioritization rules. We're also, our finance team is working hand in hand with Leslie Moss, also on our grants team, is also working hand in hand with our auditors because we want to make sure that we understand these rules explicitly before we allocate any of these funds. But we've got just a little over $10 million that we can put towards customer arrearages. And we believe that that'll give us the potential to serve between 12 and 60,000 households, depending on how these rules continue to kind of shake out and finalize. So we continue to meet with Commerce. We continue to ask lots of questions. We want to make sure that we understand the rules very clearly. We want to make sure that we've got all the appropriate documentation before we move any of these funds to customer accounts. And we also have asked and continue to kind of wait just to get the final template from Commerce so that we're able to understand what we're going to need to produce on the other side of dispersing these funds, just to make sure that we're clear there as well. But once we've got all of our questions answered, we will then disperse the funds. And we can go on to the next slide for next steps.
Jeff, this is Commissioner Olson. Just one question. This is coming directly to the PUD, correct?
That is correct.
All right, thank you.
Which again, is something that we've, we're really excited about because as I kind of mentioned 2 weeks ago, so far for any of these federal packages, we've had to work with third parties that have been the recipients to kind of get the funds eventually to our customers. These funds will go directly to us, and then we will be the grantee that will be dispersing them to the customers. All right, so our next steps. We're continuing to work with CorpCom to develop our internal and external communication strategy for customers. We know that just as important as receiving the funds is making sure that we tell the full story of what these funds mean, not only for the customers that are going to be able to receive these grants, but really for all ratepayers, because all ratepayers stand to benefit a lot from these grants, in addition to the households that will, you know, receive them individually. And then we will allocate the grants to eligible customers by December 31st. And again, that is fast upon us. And so we continue to kind of work day by day with Commerce to get all these other parts finalized so that we can disperse. And, you know, similar to the storm, this has really been an all hands on deck kind of thing. So, you know, analytics has helped us build the dashboard, finance, general accounting, customer accounting. They've been really helpful at helping us understand what balances could be eligible and what processes we've already got in place that we might be able to leverage for kind of bulk uploading of some of these grants and things like that. Customer service has been extremely helpful at helping us identify customer accounts, to helping us refine our data and make sure that we've got our data really clear. Obviously, government affairs has been working hard on our behalf from the very beginning. And so we've had all these different teams working, and we're ready to just now kind of make this finally final by the end of the year. And then we have by March 1st of 23 to report back to the legislature and Commerce how many households we served, how we did indeed prioritize the funds, and just kind of the final accounting steps. So with that, I'll open it up for questions.
Commissioner Wolf, do you have questions? Commissioner Wolf? Have we lost?
I'm sorry.
Oh, there you are. Do you have any questions?
Sorry, I had muted myself for a second. Would you repeat the amount that the new amount, Jeff, please?
Yes, it's
10 million what?
10 million 9,000. I can get the exact number here in just a moment, but it's 10 million 9,000 and then just a little bit of change after that.
Sounds good. Thank you. Congratulations on all of that achievement.
Well, that's phenomenal work. I'm impressed. I'm impressed that we built a database. I mean, that's really impressive that we can do that. Do we know what percentage this, well, we know how much will be left after the $10 million of our pandemic related arrearages?
So we don't have that number exactly at this time, but this represents a substantial piece of that. A very substantial piece of that, I guess, is what I would say.
And I imagine this will be audited by the state auditor at some point. This will be a challenging thing to audit for them.
As we understand it, because these are federal dollars, that it will actually be a part of our federal audit. If I'm not mistaken. Oh, and I see Scott moving to the podium, so this is where I'll be quiet.
Even worse.
Yeah. This has been a complexity, and I'll add my compliments to Kim and Pam and Jeff and a lot of other people that have been working very hard to get this money. The wrinkle is applying these funds. You know, they're coming to the district, but we've got to apply them to very particular customers. It sounds simple, but it's awfully complicated. Because we've got a very robust billing system. We're billing 350,000 folks every month. It's just, there's a lot going on there and how you apply and calculate. So we, each year, our audit firm, Moss Adams, is gonna come in and we'll get audited either from them. Sometimes we'll get audited, obviously, from the state auditor's office. In this particular case, it would probably be Moss Adams who's going to pick one of the federal programs and audit those. This is the magnitude of dollars. It's probably going to trip their meter and they'd be the ones that would do the audit. So Jeff alluded to this. One of the things we're trying to do on our side of the house is go back to Moss Adams and say, hey, before you even get here, let's walk through how we're planning on allocating these dollars and give us a head nod of whether this makes logical sense to you, because we don't want to allocate these dollars and then come, you know, March or April, find out that we need to give half the dollars back. And so that's been part of the work. It can be a very complicated process. It requires a whole lot of technical maneuvering. It could be a really easy application. application. And so we're trying to convince them and get everyone comfortable on the easiest possible path for allocation there, which can save a lot of work, we hope. But it's not without its ripples. But we're trying to take care of that stuff on the front end.
Well, that's great, because there's really no other way to do it. With 200 customers, we could do it manually.
Well, and
by each one,
right,
on paper, but this it has to be an automated approach.
Yeah, and we've joked internally a little bit that, look, people are going to have to put down other work for a second and try to figure this out, because unless you can come up with a project that's worth more than $10 million on your plate between now and yeah. here, we're going to try to move heaven and earth to get it done. So we've got a lot of people that have put a lot of effort into this, and standing ready to do that. We're trying to come up with the easiest possible path, and the auditors have been great helping us and giving us some good feedback.
Well, it's a huge lift. Thank you, everyone that's involved.
Superb work. This commissioner also just a couple of questions, and through this process, I just may have forgotten. These are credits on their checks, on their bill, right? Okay.
Correct.
And this is residential and commercial?
Just residential customers.
Just residential, okay.
I do have that the full figure to Commissioner Wolf's previous question. It's $10 million, $10,009,095.67.
Thank you. It's 10 a.m. Commissioners, do we need a 5-minute break?
It's like you're in my mind.
Commissioner Olson, can we actually take 15 minutes?
I'm gonna work on some tech issues. All right. Well, let's. We will take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 10:15 a.m. It's 10:15, and we are reconvening our morning study session. I'll turn it back over to Guy.
Okay, next we have Dears and Mar. He's got a couple of presentations. He's going to go through back-to-back here, Climate Commitment Act, cost burden forecasting will be the first, and then we'll talk about our Western Resource Adequacy program updates. Garrison.
Good morning. Morning, commissioners. And Guy is right. I've got two presentations back to back. They're both a little dense, but they're also pretty short. And the sneak preview is the first presentation is going to be something that's a little bit dense that we want to prepare the commission to take action on. The second presentation is something that's also pretty dense, and we want to prepare the commission not to take action on. And we'll unpack the nuts and bolts of why that is.
Well, that's why you're up here, because you were able to take dance to something we'll
understand. And you're hoping we're not dense.
I was going to say, there's an amazing dance joke here somewhere for us. But let's roll through this, and Ian was going to present this. He's not available today, so I'm pinch hitting. And might look to some of my friends from government relations to help out if we get some questions that are pretty detailed. But Ian came to the commission on October 18th, and he really gave a high-level look at what the Climate Commitment Act was and how that was going to affect us as a utility that could be considered a covered entity under that program. Today, specifically, we're going to be talking about forecast allowances, which are allowances for carbon emissions, and an action that we would recommend that this commission take, not today, but in the next meeting, to account for this and to help the PUD participate in this program. So we'll walk through what that is and why that is, and that will set us up for the next commission meeting to take some action on it. And like I said before, no action today, just the informational briefing. We'll make sure that we have a chance to talk about the rules and the specific part of the rules that that would compel us to do something now. And we'll talk about the recommendation, which specifically is to update our clean energy implementation plan, which was adopted by this commission in December of 2021, so that it includes a cost burden forecast for the Climate Commitment Act. We'll talk about what that is. So that's where we're headed. And we want to make sure that we're talking about the relevant section of the Climate Commitment Act rules. And at the highest level, One of the things that the Climate Commitment Act does is it creates this cap and invest framework where emissions are accounted for, it links to California's program, and it creates a market for emissions, credits, and allowances. And one of the things that our state legislature said is that the Clean Energy Transformation Act, or CETA, is really the governing statute that directs utilities to make their portfolios cleaner over time. And as a result, there was a carve-out in the Climate Commitment Act that says this act will not create any additional cost burden on utilities who are already working to comply with CETA. And what we didn't know is what the rules would look like to calculate what a cost burden is and how we would access that cost burden. Final rules have come out, and now we need to take an action so that the Department of Ecology can see us and see that cost burden and provide us with some emission allowances that will help mitigate the cost burden for our customers. So that's what this is about, and it's going to be a forecast based on retail load, and the forecast has to be approved by a governing board. That's you, the commission, and we do have the opportunity to update all the way through June 2023, but the staff recommendation is we'd like to make a forecast update very soon through adoption of an update to the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. And Ecology is directed by the state to take all the forecasts, calculate the cost burden based on their formula, and issue allowances. Very high level. I'll pause and see if there's any questions there.
Does the cost burden include staff time that it takes to do this process so that we have no burden?
By statute, yes. The rules are a little bit different than that. But we've already instituted a time code here at the district. And is there a bond? And we're tracking that administrative time now. So we'll move to the recommendation for the forecast, what we're recommending and the action that we propose. So we would like to update the Clean Energy Implementation Plan just to include an appendix that's specific to the CCA. Wouldn't change anything else about the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, what our targets are, what our actions are. It would just have an emissions forecast specific for this law. We need it. Because when the Clean Energy Implementation Act, Implementation Plan statute was passed, and when we adopted our Clean Energy Implementation Plan, CCA didn't exist. So we didn't think about it, we couldn't think about it, and that's why we need to add this. Ecology has said that they will go first to Clean Energy Implementation Plan forecasts, and next, to forecasts submitted and approved by utilities governing boards. We think that it's just more clear and limits the possibility of miscommunication in a very new law. We do all those things in one step. So including it in the CEIP and having that also be the forecast adopted by the governing board eliminates confusion and points exactly to what it should be. And this is a slide that describes what I just said in words. Apologize, and a reminder that I'm pinch hitting for Ian here. But you know, we want to make sure that it's very clear to Ecology what the forecast should be, and we want to make sure that the CEIP has the benefit of understanding the CCA, which it couldn't have done before, and which you know we need to update. The next couple slides talk a little bit about why that is and why it's important for us to have this appendix. So the first piece is that if we do nothing and Ecology follows the formula that is in their rules without the benefit of additional guidance from our utility, there's a potential that we could get as little as zero allowances. But we think that with the best forecast available to us and consistent with what our peers are doing, The appropriate forecast allowances is approximately $250,000. And because these allowances can cost as much as $60 a piece, potentially, or what the market value of each of these are, clearly the potential, right, of getting zero when we need $250,000 could be a material financial impact to the district that we need to make sure we're taking proactive action to address. So that's really why we feel like we need to do something, because of that potential delta there. And the reason for that is what the CEIP thought about, what the CEIP statute asked for, and what CCA asked for and how they're different. So the Clean Energy Implementation Plan really asks that document to contain estimates of renewable energy and non-emitting energy or nuclear energy. So we did that to the T, got audited, went well, but we did not include estimates of market purchases or those parts of the portfolio that could have emissions associated with it. Clean Energy Implementation Plan statute didn't ask us to, and as a result, we didn't include it. Fundamentally, what we'd be doing in this forecast is just including it in a forecast that is an appendix. There's two places where those emissions come from. The first is Bonneville. So Bonneville is, you know, generally upwards of 90% carbon-free. And then there's balancing market purchases that we and utilities like us need to make to balance our variable renewable resources like wind and solar and biomass. So we need to include those things. We would use EPA's forecast of emissions to include that. And we would use a methodology that they use in California's cap and trade program to estimate our balancing purchases. Those are the two items that we would include.
A question on that. Market is treated as emitting. We need fossil fuels, or even though that great power can be 95% renewable, but it's considered in a block, right?
It is, unless it's a specified market purchase that is from a renewable source. And we have made some of those on a forward basis to reduce our exposure. But if you do not have that documentation, then it does have a default assumption that it has some emissions, and it's just a default rate that gets assigned to it. And clearly, right, everything that Bonneville's doing, we don't necessarily have control over how they're balancing their portfolio that we receive a piece of, and that's where most of our emissions come from. So slide 7 contains the pieces that we need this forecast to see, not kind of outside the scope of the CEIP, so we want to include it in that scope. Mentioned before that if we think about what the cost of the $250,000 or thereabouts emission allowances could be if we had to purchase those from the market, depending on what the auction price comes, which is a range, and we've not had an auction here, right? It could be anywhere from $6 to $12 million is a reasonable estimate. So it's important that we take an action to reduce our exposure here. And this last slide here, we're at the home stretch, is really how would we update the CEIP, and want to make sure that we're not fundamentally changing the plan of what we would do in the next 4 years. That's in the primary purpose of the CEIP, is to say what conservation, demand response, renewable resources, storage would we add to the portfolio over the next 4 years. What we're really trying to do is say our forecast of our portfolio includes these resources in our existing portfolio, includes this retail load forecast, and also includes in this appendix these carbon emissions. It's just the carbon emissions that we'll be changing and adding to that document. And that is really the whole story. So we would come back to the commission with a proposed Appendix A. There are some appendices to this slide deck that show exactly what we anticipate that will look like. We'll format that, and we would propose that for incorporation into the Clean Energy Implementation Plan that was adopted December 2021. We'd write a letter to Ecology, letting them know that we've made that change. The forecast was adopted, it's contained in the CEIP, and that's where they can calculate our allowances from.
Commissioner Holt has some questions. Can you tell her to push star 9 and she should be able to talk?
Commissioner Wolf is not on.
Ask her to.
Commissioner Wolf, you can hear me. Would you do star 9? Dial star 9. Commissioner Wolf, are you on?
She's on mute.
She's on her phone, so she unmute herself on her phone by dialing star 9.
So what does that tell me?
She needs to dial star 9.
She still needs to dial
and unmute. Make sure that her phone is not muted itself too.
Sorry for the technical problem.
Remember, you're on your cell phone calling in, so you need to push star 9 and make sure your phone's not muted. Something went wrong. Please try again.
Oh, wow.
That's what we're
spies. Well,
So maybe I've asked this before. These are all forecasts. Is there a truing up?
There is a true up process in the rules that's not been implemented yet. So there's still some pieces of that that we don't have perfect clarity on how that will be operationalized. So we're trying to minimize our risk by getting the forecast as close to what we think will happen is possible, so that we're leaning less on that true-up mechanism, which does exist in Ecology's final rules.
Yeah, and amending the CEIP makes sense. I guess I just still struggle legislatively. Why, if they wanted us to do something different, why didn't they rewrite CETA or something? Why do we have this extra layer that's not supposed to be a burden, it's clearly a burden? I just don't understand the process. Why didn't they just exclude utilities?
Yeah, I don't have any special knowledge there, but one thing that's interesting potentially is CETA was all about us as utilities.
Right.
It was about our clean energy transformation, and this Climate Commitment Act is really about the whole of Washington economy, so everything from gasoline to electricity.
I don't have a question, just a comment. This is deep stuff for me, but what I appreciate is the way these things are brought forward in multiple meetings and multiple presentations. The last one was October 18th. It really helps me to build on when we get to this point, understanding why. Very helpful for me.
We really appreciate that feedback. We know it's dense, and we want to give you guys the best information, but we do want to make sure that we're doing it once the ink's dried a little bit, and we all have a chance as a industry to understand it.
Do we have Commissioner Wolf on?
She cannot seem to unmute, so she's going to have to dial back in. She does have a question. We can take a recess for her to go.
She does have a question.
Or she wants me to relate the question, or we can just take a 5-minute break.
I wonder if she could email you.
Can she hear us?
Have her email or send the question.
Can Commissioner Wolf hear us?
Yes.
All right.
Go ahead and email it to me and we'll read it.
You have.
Commissioner Wilson, I was just going to pile on to your comments and say that, you know, the team really does a great job of working on these issues with our government relations team, legal, the different trade organizations we're a part of, and our peer utilities. So really is kind of a cross-functional team effort. They put a lot into this and
yeah.
really help lead the way. So just a big shout out to them.
It helps this commissioner a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Has she emailed her question?
Maybe we can pick it up after the wrap one.
Mind by me if it works for you all.
We move on.
Well, we have the same presenter, so.
Okay. Yeah, let's move on. And then when we can get her question, we can refer back to this.
I got it now.
Oh, you get the question, please.
No cost allowances. Please explain further.
Okay, perfect. So the question was, can you explain no cost allowances further? So in general, right, if we did not have a no cost allowance, we would need to purchase a carbon allowance from the market, right? And the prices, those allowances are set by the auction prices. That's why we had that range of, I think it was $30 to $50 there. We don't know what that price will look like, but we have to purchase them from that auction. But the no-cost allowances would be issued to us at no cost from the program administrator. Those would go to offset those carbon emissions that we forecast could have happened because of our Bonneville contract and because of our balancing purchases to integrate our renewable energy. And so we would get those at no cost. Really, the alternative here is if you don't have enough no-cost allowances, you've got to go get those, right, from the auction. And that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to make sure that the cost burden to our customers is taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Walt, does that answer your question? Well, let's move on to the next presentation, and I'll ask at the end of that presentation if Commissioner Walt heard you.
That sounds perfect.
Okay.
Great. Well, Chapter 1 was a complicated topic with some commission action. This is a complicated topic again, but here we're going to propose no commission action in the near term. And it's equally important that we explain why, because this is a really big regional effort, and we want to make sure that we're fairly characterizing where we're at and what the staff recommendation is. And I've got Jeff Kallstrom with me, who's just done a terrific job representing the district, some of the program development activities. I believe Jofina, who is in Denver right now for a markets development committee, is also calling in. And there's a big team that we've assembled to work through this as a district to make the best possible choice for our customers. So let's talk about what that looks like. Want to do a quick refresher on what the Western Resource Adequacy Program, or RAP, is, just to make sure that we have that context. Share a little bit of the staff analysis that we have done, but we're not going to go overboard with it because we anticipate coming back to this commission in the spring. And ultimately, we want to share the basis of staff's recommendation to wait on RAP participation, really until some BPA processes have worked their way through the system, and we'll share why that is. Which means that for commission, there's no decision or actions today, but we did want to prepare this commission for what we might come back with in the spring and make sure that our governing board has an understanding of what the RAP context is, what the lay of the land is, and what staff's position is at this time. A quick background, RAP is a regional effort to address capacity concerns, and it really does this by creating uniform planning standards across participants, which stretch this time from Canada all the way down to the Mexican border in the western United States, so broad participation there. So consistent planning standards are not something the industry has now. This introduces them, and it also creates the resource pool that participants can access if we get close to a blackout-like event, so folks can access that pool. The district has been participating since the beginning here. We've done some hard work and really improved the design from the beginning. stages to where it is now. And where it is now specifically is transitioning from the last of that design to a participation phase where folks need to come in and say, I will participate in a binding manner, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. At this specific date, we sign a participation agreement, which requires at least 2 years of funding before a utility can exit. So it's getting more real, and we need to make sure that we're making a really thoughtful decision. Staff has looked at what this program could look like when it's fully mature, has broad participation, and there's a lot of promise here, and we're excited about it. In fact, that we think once it has robust participation, this is going to be, from our perspective, the lowest cost way to meet the 1 in 10 loss of load expectation risk threshold, which is an industry standard. So it's a lowest cost insurance for us and our customers to make sure that we've got that blackout mitigation there. We also think that this program, once mature, will produce new capacity markets, which would be really interesting to the district, who has bought products from capacity markets as they exist today and expects to in the future. And we expect that RAP could become a component of future organized markets that also have tremendous potential for Snohomish and VPA. But in order for all of these things to be true, there does have to be a critical mass of participants that creates the resource and the load diversity that create those markets, opportunities, and also really create kind of a balanced resource pool to access. And there are many doors to open in this transition, and that makes it a complicated process. Finding operations means that the utility has committed to meet the program requirements under, you know, the potential penalty of non-compliance. And one of the things that the program is asking participants to do now is to name the year in which they would be a binding participant, and also to sign a participation agreement, which would start January 1st of next year to go all the way until they are fully in the program. So you can be a participant in the program and not be binding. It means that if you don't have enough resources, you're not penalized, but you also have differential access to what those resources in the pool are. And then there's the other tranche, which is binding participants, which pay into the program just like non-binding, but they do have access to that resource pool, and they do have a penalty if they don't bring all the resources that they're required to into the program. So those are kind of the pieces that we need to work through, right? When do we sign a participation agreement, binding or non-binding, and when do we expect we could be binding? And because we think that most of the benefits come from having that critical mass, what others choose to do here is extremely important for what we would choose to do. The biggest mover is BPA, and BPA has said that they will join as late in the, kind of the option set as possible, late in 2027 or late in 2028. Others have followed that lead, and they're also sharing that perspective that that's their expectation. You can still move earlier, but we understand that that is where most people are at, and because binding participants create the critical mass, create, you know, the robust potential capacity markets and the resource pool, that changes the value proposition a little bit if folks are going later, right?
So I was looking at 27, 28. So from Bonneville's perspective, this 27 coincides with the new contract. Is that something, is that the reason that they pushed it out?
It's not the primary reason, okay. But that is kind of a convenient coincidence, I would say.
I get it now. Okay.
Bonneville has identified that they may have some issues serving a portion of load in Southwest Idaho, consistent with program requirements, and they're worried that that could create some potential penalty costs. And that's why they have said they'd like to potentially push back. Another part that's important for us to think about is when we sign this participation agreement, we're essentially committing to funding this program for a minimum of 2 years, which means that we really want to be confident that we'll get value from this for our customers across those 2 years. One of the other pieces that's Bonneville specific is that they will require a non-conforming agreement, which means an agreement different from everybody else in this Western Resource Adequacy Program. And that's because they have really specific federal statutes that Bonneville must abide by. So they need to have that agreement in place and agreed to by the RAP program operator. And they don't have it in place. And so if we take the totality of all of these things, right? Binding participants expected to be later in the timeline, kind of eroding the near-term benefits, in the short term at least, Bonneville not having their participation agreement all the way approved by the power pool or by FERC. What staff recommend right now is that rather than rush and sign an agreement like some of our peers may, and indicating a potential year that we would bind ourselves, we should instead wait until we are confident that Bonneville's participating agreement will be approved by FERC and the power pool, and that they will be a participant in the program, because we know that we're not likely to be successful without Bonneville in that program, and we know that we'd be committing to at least 2 years, potentially ahead of Bonneville, if their non-conforming agreement gets thrown out. So I can appreciate that that's a complicated sequence of logic, but I think the headline is pretty simple. We can best steward our customers' dollars by waiting until we are confident there will be a high value proposition for those customers. We don't want to get locked into 2 years of funding the program if we're not sure that EPA and others like EPA will participate. So we would like to wait, come back after FERC approval of EPA's non-conforming agreement, and pick it up then, where we have much deeper analysis of what the potential benefits could be, but when we have an action for this board to consider.
So has there been an effort, I imagine there has, to help move EPA along? EDC or others? I mean, this is a little frustrating because this was born out of a real need. A couple of very specific incidents in the Northwest. We got close to running out of energy. And, you know, there had been so much positive coming out of this. They're very encouraging. It's sort of, I agree with what we should do, but I'm just frustrated that Bonneville, it seemed like if they're worried about one area, there could be a workaround for that. We applied pressure, I guess.
Jeff may
our delegation or whoever needs to do it. I mean, this is a big issue for our region.
I'd say generally we've been applying pressure for several years on the program, but Jeff is, and Joe as well, who's on the phone, have been engaging directly with Bonneville and PPC to see what can be done. Jeff?
Jeff Kallstrom, Interim General Counsel. So as Garrison noted, Joe is working with Bonneville and others on the technical side, working on the FERC filing, that type of thing. I've worked on the Participants Committee. And as you noted, PPC has been working directly with Bonneville. And both Joe and I have been working, as well as Garrison, working with PPC to push Bonneville pretty hard on this. We're really down to just a couple of sticking points, and what we're running into is a little bit of a kind of a chicken and egg timing problem, and that's why we're looking at potentially coming back as soon as the spring, so in just a couple of months, and our hope is by that point these issues will be resolved. Bonneville's non-conforming agreement will have been filed with FERC and accepted with by FERC at that point. So our hope, our best case scenario, is that in just a couple of months we're back here ready to go forward. We have certainty on what Bonneville is going to do, and so we'll be in a much better position at that point. Thank you.
Well, along that same line, I was thinking, you said that you have utilities that are ready to step and make a commitment.
That's correct, yeah.
So I'm confused that, excuse me, if you're sharing resources, you make a commitment, there might not, they, and another utility, other utilities don't. Are you out there trying to find something and it's not there?
One of the novel things about the program is that it can adjust for the numbers of participants in the program, but shared in an earlier slide that we expect with robust participation, this could be the least cost path for meeting that loss of load, a risk threshold for the smaller number of participants. It's gradually more expensive, right?
Yeah.
And so the program is most cost effective with most robust participation. So that's why we want to continue to apply pressure to move participation in that direction, starting with Bonneville, because we think that would be good for us, for the region, and address this issue proactively head on. But this is the program, right? And we have responsibilities to our customers with or without this program. So these are the immediate next steps, but there are additional next steps that we need to take on.
Yeah.
And that looks like the following slide, which is, we want to continue to support this program. We want to continue to advocate to Bonneville to participate as appropriate and at the earliest time periods. We also expect to prepare our operational strategy as if we could be a binding rapid participant in the earliest possible time period. Bonneville can move its date up, and we'd likely advocate for that. We need to be ready to move up to the earliest possible date as well. We've learned quite a bit from participating in this program, what our capacity requirements would be, and we could be making all of the plans today to meet those same thresholds so that we're ready. And if the program doesn't materialize and we wind up meeting those requirements, you know, on our own, then we've done well by our customers to prepare for these events, and that's what we propose to do.
It's from Canadian border down to the Mexican border. Is there some threshold that you need in terms of those that have made a commitment?
And
those that haven't?
It's not necessarily the volume of participants, though there are 29 now, so that'd be great. But it's more the megawatts of capacity and the megawatts of load. So if we could get a smaller number of capacity-rich utilities in there, that would be better than having a larger number of.
Just one point of clarification. It can go north of the Canadian border as well.
Up
into Canada.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd expect PowerX.
PowerX, yeah. Okay. Commissioner Logan. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
are you done with your presentation?
That's it, yeah. So this is a staff recommendation to take no action at this time, but wanted to make sure that we were clear and had a good discussion about why that's the case and when we expect to come back.
Commissioner Logan?
My only question is, matter right now, I don't know the answer, is are we going to have to procure new resources to be part of the RAP?
I think that there is a lot of alignment with what our plans were already before RAP. We came and talked about an acquisition of a 25 megawatt battery a couple weeks ago. We also shared that we'd already acquired Forward Winter Energy to meet future winters with resource-specific renewable energy, thinking about the Climate Commitment Act, which was the the presentation right before this. So we are making those steps. The 2023 IRP will kick off pretty soon. It will have a resource adequacy layer to it so that we can make sure that the planning framework that we use can have this additional layer to say, and what does that mean for that? Make sure that we've got all those pieces covered.
Thank you. Don't go away. We have Commissioner Wolf on now. Should we? Commissioner Wolf, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Could you repeat the answer to the Commissioner Wolf had an answer to the previous presentation, and I don't think she heard your answer. Had a question.
No, but I can listen to the recording and get that information. Let's not do that now. So I just had, if I can get back. I just had a comment that I think the RAP has great potential for us. And I think it is something that as soon as possible that we need to share with the public, because when I hear so many people asking me, well, how are we going to meet our needs? I tell them we have a lot of programs in the works and you will be hearing about them. And we're also working on, you know, more ways to save energy, conservation, all of these different programs. So I'm trying to ease their minds and I think of the RAP frequently, and I've been hearing about it in lots of different meetings for a long time. And I think it's very interesting and very promising. So I guess that's all I'll say about it right now, that I hope that the public can be assured that we do have a program that has to do with sharing back and forth with other utilities in our region, including California. So that may be coming, that we're working on it. But I think it's a very promising program. So that's all I want to say about that now.
Thank you, Commissioner Wolf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Guy, let's move on to our next item.
Thank you, Garrison. Next, we have Kevin Labrin with our Connect Up Commission quarterly update.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Kevin Labrin.
Good morning.
On the Connect Up program. Here with Tim Epp, part of our program leadership, along with our friends from HR, Amanda Bowman and Angie Michelson, will be sharing a part of our presentation today. We were last here providing our quarterly update on the Connect Up program in June 2022. So the purpose of the presentation is to continue to provide the commission a progress update of the program, and also to provide a description of an upcoming contract amendment with Z2 Solutions. They've been our AMI consultant all along this journey. We'll talk about that amendment in just a few minutes. So the expectations of the board is to remain updated of recent program activities and next steps, along with future approval on December 6th of the Z2 Solutions AMI consultant amendment. So our agenda today will be, we'll go over our program schedule, where we are today, along with our budget review. We'll then talk about some key phases of what's going on in our current phase of the project, key areas around the implementation phase, reporting on our base station development, the build out that's taken place throughout the district, our meter installation planning that's taking place, our current system integration work, training, and our internal and external communications. And then HR will be sharing with us information around our meter reader transition. And then I'll wrap up with our Z2 contract amendment review and provide a summary of that, and then talk about next steps. Just a reminder of the main components of the program, with our AMI network project being led by Jeff Cullen, our systems integration and meter data management system projects being led by Doris Payne, meter deployment project being led by Travis Olson, our build out of our test environment being led by Nick Johnston, and our AMI Technologies Group, our operations group, being led by Adam Perretti. High-level schedule, so we're currently in the center phase there, the implementation phase. And again, this is where we're focusing on our systems integration work, currently doing testing right now. We're building out our base station network, and we're also doing our planning for our meter deployment. So we'll be providing updates on those areas in just a few minutes. And this phase currently is scheduled to wrap up mid-2023. So as far as our budget snapshot today, as of the end of September, budget numbers that we have spent $19 million on the program. our current budget estimate today was $20.1 million, so we're about $1 million under budget right now. However, this is a snapshot today. We have lengthened out some of our systems integration testing and have had some delays with our meter shipments arriving here that will be taking place. And so we expect majority of this $1 million being utilized for extra work that we'll be doing the first part of 2023.
Excuse me, Commissioner Wolf, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's hard to know the timing. If I could ask a question about, there's a figure in the 2022 budget booklet that we got. It was on page 10, and it said connect up, and this is in the million, $34,508,000. Now, where did that figure come from, and how does that compare to the 19,000, for example, that we have spent so far?
Okay, I'd have to look at that page. Can you explain the 20? You said 24 million. Was that a
No. Okay, sorry. This was in the 20. This was in the 2022. It says significant 2022 electric system capital projects or programs in the millions. Okay, connect up. 34,508,000.
Right. Yes.
And so I'm just trying to make sense of the different amounts for 2022 and what we've actually spent through September 2022.
Sure. That was probably an estimate that we had when we thought we were receiving meters this year. We were planning on building up an inventory of about 50,000 meters by the end of December of this year. And so we thought we'd be spending more capital on the project at that time. Now the meters are delayed until end of second quarter of 2023, we've moved those dollars out to the appropriate year. And so our budget for 2022 came down accordingly.
Yeah, that makes totally good sense. So at some point we'll see the difference in those two amounts moved over to 2023 budget, right?
Yes, a portion. We're expecting a certain number of meters, mostly the latter half of 2023. We are receiving meters planned for 2024 and then also into 2025 due to the supply chain delays. So the cost for the meters has remained the same throughout this budget. So it's just moving it to different years.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner
Hoffman. So do we have a sense of the overall spend for the entire project, how we're doing relative to the business case?
Yes, thank you for asking that question. I was just about to bring that up. Great. Yes, so the budget that we had approved was $93.2 million originally for the project. And then we had a ten percent contingency on top of that, which is $9 million. Right now, looking at the potential risk items with inflationary pressures and such, right now we are still planning to be under budget a little bit. Right now we're trending about $300,000 under that $93.2 million. And so that includes, I'll be talking about some additional base stations that we think we're going to need in the district, and some other factors that are associated with that, a couple other contract increases. But we've had savings throughout the project on some of our contract work plus internal labor. And so that's what brings it back down into within the $93.2 million budget.
And therefore, the contingency, you're not into the contingency.
We're not into that. Our goal is to not use the contingency.
No, I understand. I'm looking for that money.
Okay. Any other questions on the budget? Just one other point, you know, as far as potential risks to our budget also, I mentioned, you know, we have our base stations, our meters are set within our contract. So we have, fortunately, we have those prices already established, already budgeted. One potential risk that we're looking at is our cost for the meter exchanges, the labor costs associated with that.
With
wages going up, we have a set amount that's budgeted for that. We still feel it's a good number. There's still a great interest in working at PUD for meter readers right now. I know there's still been some hiring to fill some openings there, and so a lot of interest in those jobs. And so we feel it's a similar type of job, and so we are hopeful that there will still be a lot of interest to help us out with that risk. So, but that overall budget for meter exchangers is $3 million. So it's about a little over 3% of our overall budget. So there might be some pressures on that.
Well, and I would say that's a risk we have with every project going forward.
Yes.
Is meter cost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bringing meter readers on board, are you talking about those that are exchanging the meters?
Sorry.
That will be time limited?
Yes, thank you. Yes, meter exchangers that will be time limited employees.
And so they're already on board?
No, so there were two things, probably mixed these up. So the meter readers today, not part of our program, as there are openings, they're hiring new people.
All right, okay, gotcha. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
I got it.
Great.
Okay. Question?
Yes.
In the budget, how do we account for the labor cost, or is that part of the program support, or what?
Our internal labor costs, yes, they are a part of this program budget, and they are shown. Our actual spend do make up part of the $19 million that we've spent today. The exchanger costs,
okay,
will also be part of that future budget that we have.
And that includes the salaries and all the labor connected with all of this?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
This is
good.
IT, the meter exchangers, the business program team, everybody.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so we're going to talk about some of the highlights during our what is occurring during our implementation phase of the program. So as far as some key areas around our base station network deployment. So currently on schedule, Jeff Colon is leading this project, 58 base stations out of the 141 of our original plan have been installed to date, and installations are on schedule. As far as our network design, there are still some remaining base station locations that we're trying to optimize the location on. So we're working with Census on that. They're currently conducting an analysis for that. There is a potential for an additional 10 to 20 base stations that we'll need for coverage. We do have budget already planned out within the project for that. And so there, there could be some potential additional costs associated with that. But again, we have money available for that within our existing budget. And then permitting, we've made some great progress with the city of Everett and Island County. Those were ones that were taking a little bit longer. And so those are mostly completed at this time. And then as far as upcoming activities, this project will continue to plan on one to two base stations per week being installed and finalizing that RF design so that we finalize the location of our final base stations where they'll be installed. As far as risks and challenges, lead time for permits has always been a challenge. We're through most of the jurisdictions, still working with the city of Edmonds. We've had some delays with that, but we're working with the city to get through those. Also, our base stations themselves, the equipment, which we have a picture of right here, that box. So we have a communications technician installing a base station at one of at the Harbor Point substation. And so that box, that electronic equipment from Census, there is a delay of 22 of the base stations that we were planning on getting December, January. They are now delayed to June. And so because of that, we won't be able to install those until July and August timeframe. So what does that mean to us? Well, there's some work we can still do ahead of time. We can still install the poles ahead of time, so we'll have that ready. And then this will be, I don't want to say it's easier work, but it's not as complex to be able to install the remaining base stations and have them set up on the Census network. There's another matter on that. Yeah, I think that is it for that. So we'll continue to work with Census to monitor this delay that we have. But as far as our coverage, network coverage that we have, because next summer we're going to start installing meters, there's plenty of areas in our county that will be fully covered already by our base station network. And so we'll start in those areas first, and the remaining areas will wrap up in time.
Are we installing these in reflecting on the storm we just had? Are we reflecting these in installing these in pretty robust areas? So they're likely not to go down. Ironically, there's trees next to your picture, but they're pretty short trees.
Yeah, that's a great question.
I mean, just because we're messaging that we're going to be able to tell people their power's out, we're going to know it. And
right.
When their power's back on. But if the base station gets taken out by a tree.
Yeah.
So that's,
yeah, that is always always a risk. They do have battery backups on them, and so they're still able to communicate out during that time. The meters themselves have batteries in them. They can communicate for some time also. So that's some of the advantage when the power is out. These are still able to work for some time.
I guess isn't there the potential if one base station goes down that others may be able to connect with the meter also?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of our meters will have at least two base stations covering.
Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, as far as our meter installation planning, we touched on some of this already. We have received our first pallet of meters, and so that's a good sign. It's I think our meter vendor Census is showing that, hey, we are starting to get, there was a component in these, the microprocessor, the microcontroller chip that the auto industry, computer industry have been using. Their supplier is now starting to provide those to Census again, and so they were able to build out these brand new meters for us. Now the intention is for us to start do our initial friends and family testing with these and some initial installations with these. However, the real delivery of meters won't start again until the second quarter of 2023.
This is our second choice of the meters we were going to use. I thought that
that's
the first choice we didn't think we could get.
Right.
We wanted.
This was our first choice.
Okay, well, that's
yes.
good. I like that a lot.
Good. This is our first choice. Yeah, Acclarometers. We have an order for those just to help cover us in case there's a delay with the first choice. So we still have that order in place, but we primarily will be meeting on this. Yeah.
Good.
Also, so again, you mentioned Travis Olson is our project manager for this project, doing a great job on it. Our first article testing meters, these are meters that we test out to ensure that they're configured exactly the way we want them. We've completed 9 out of the 16 first article tests, testing meter tests, and remaining 7 meters will be showing up, we're told, in December, and we'll be able to complete our tests for those also.
December this year or next year?
This year, thank you. Yeah, you have to ask that these days, I understand. Great. Warehouse plans, so those have been approved, the 75th building, and accepted, and so that the construction has already started on that in preparation for all the meters to be showing up and our whole process of loading our vans with those meters and having the exchangers go out and do their work. Also, Travis has led the team in developing the friends and family deployment plan, and so our plan is in June, after our systems go live early June, is to install, using our new processes, our new system, to install 22 meters at that time. 15 of these will be electric, 7 will be water meters in different locations. I'm hoping I get one of those and try it out at my house. So we'll be testing out our new processes at that time, ensuring that things are working well. In preparation for our larger deployment that will start up towards the end of July. As far as upcoming activities, completing the 75th building warehouse remodel, getting the certificate of occupancy in the first quarter of 23, finalizing the procurement of our 30 vans, and so those are being outfitted right now. They physically exist. We're excited about that. So they'll be showing up in December, maybe a few in January for us to use. We'll also be second quarter next year finalizing our hiring and training plans. So with Census, we're planning on in March of 23 of getting our best estimate of when and how many meters will be showing up. And then based on that, we'll put into action our hiring plans and start bringing people on accordingly. And then finalizing our deployment strategy and plans, I just mentioned that. We'll finalize that in the second quarter. So as far as risks and challenges, we've spoke on the meter supply chain. We see that the status is improving. We'll get that update in the first quarter of 23. Mentioned the potential inflationary pressures on meter exchanger costs. We talked about that already. And an increase in the Aclara contract costs. So because of our meter exchange work going out longer into 2025 now, taking a longer time frame, the handheld equipment that we're leasing from Aclara, we'll need that for a longer time. Also some more support time from Aclara. So we're expecting 10 to 15% increase in that contract. It's not a large contract, so we've had earlier savings in that project that will cover that cost. So we're not seeing that hurting the budget overall for this project. Okay, the systems integration project. It's working. There we go. So Doris Payne, leading our systems integration project. A lot of work taking place here, a lot of people involved. We're currently involved with systems integration testing. Phase one was completed a few months ago, and we're in the middle of phase two of our testing. Phase three will be, we're planning on it right now and getting prepared for it. So that will be starting in January of 2023, and that's where we'll be testing more end-to-end. Right now, we're testing more individual software, individual systems, and our end-to-end testing will then start up with phase three with our district employees conducting that testing. Also, first quarter of 23, we'll be performing, conducting our performance testing, and that's where we'll be replicating the exchanging of 1,000 meters a day, which is what will our peak exchange rate will eventually be, making sure that will work properly. And then user acceptance testing, second quarter of 23, and so that's where we'll actually bring in the real end users, and they will start trying, testing out the new processes with our QA system that we have. And then we'll complete our go live planning in the first quarter of 23 also. So some of the risks and challenges associated, systems integration testing, definitely it went longer than we originally planned. We kept pushing, kept saying, you know, quality is very important for us. We want this to launch well. We want it to go well. And so we applied a lot of pressure to that, probably made testing, our testing duration take longer than planned. And so we had to move our go live date out to June of 23. This is still within the needed time frame window for our meters showing up. So there was no delay to the overall program.
Don't want to interrupt you, but before you leave the part, the upcoming activities, regarding user acceptance testing, does that include the people who are opting out?
So user acceptance testing is internal district employees who are testing. We will not be live.
That's your friends and family program.
It's just before that. So user acceptance testing is actually the users of our business systems. They'll be trying it out. We won't be technically live at that point. So we won't be talking to any meters. Customers will not be impacted or involved just yet. So this is just internal employees who will be conducting testing.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't clear on that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So this is the integration with all our systems, our billing systems.
Yes.
Our app that people will be looking to see their usage. It's the integration of all of those things.
It's, yeah, all the systems that we have in scope to set up this foundation for AMI, and then also to enable us to be able to launch future apps. Other capabilities that we'll have.
I mean, just kind of things.
I get a headache just thinking how complex it is. You haven't given me a headache. Well, just when you're talking about corporate systems and integration.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have Doris Payne leading it. She is definitely one of the best, the right person to be doing this.
It's not only complex, it's work that we're doing on top of everything else we have to do. So flying an airplane and we're building a new plane at the same time,
right?
And we expect that when it launches, it's going to be seamless,
yeah,
and even better. And it's just really, so it's a huge lift.
Exactly. It's great to see the great district employees and really great vendors that we're working with too, and all that they're juggling with their daytime jobs and helping out with this. It definitely is a heavy lift.
And you mentioned delay.
Yes.
But my mantra is, delays are okay, you just need to get it right.
Right, thank you.
Now that's only coming from one commissioner.
I like that. Yeah, they say that people remember quality. If things are delayed some, they might not remember that, but they remember if it went right. Thank you. And so we've had some adjustments too with this project, so many people working on it, a lot of vendors. And so the team has adapted well to the hybrid environment, which we've really had to utilize. And so I think that's been working really well. And again, you know, we've talked about scope management. Doris Payne and the other project managers doing a great job managing scope for the projects. And I think that's really helped out keep us within budget too. Any questions? Other questions on systems integration?
This is Commissioner Wolf.
Yes.
Whenever you have a lot of different vendors, that increases the involvement of our cyber people. You know, I'm not I can't remember if they're part of IT or if they're separate from IT, but I'm going to assume and hope that they're doing their due diligence on checking vendors to make sure that we don't have any, you know, opportunities for any cyber slip-ups or anything like that.
Yes, we have Kevin Johnston, cybersecurity, involved with project. Also early on, you know, with a number of vendors who are working with our systems and such, we processes have been set up to bring them on board, have them trained, ensure that things are secure with their interactions with our network and working with us. So, and we've taken all the necessary precautions to help out with that.
Good.
All right, thank you. Okay, now I'll turn the next portion of our presentation over to Tim Epp, who's part of our program leadership. We'll be talking about training and communications.
Morning, commissioners. A key part of our program, of course, is making sure that our employees are ready for the new systems that are coming in and all of the changes that we're making to those systems and to our processes. So training is absolutely viewed as key to a successful program overall. Since we were last with you, we have identified our change champions. So the change champions are the ones who help us disseminate information out to various work groups and making sure that people are aware and understand the changes that are coming their way. And we'll continue to feed them information as we get closer, more and more detailed information. We've also identified our testers who will be part of not only our phase three testing, but also our user acceptance testing, which is coming. And so around that, we are working to bring them up to speed, and that's some of the training that is already underway in making sure the change champions, our testers, are trained in these changes that are coming and understand not only the changes, but then how to test and how to train as well. So a lot of effort by our training team in that. Training curriculum is already underway for some of those changes, but on our upcoming activity, that curriculum development will be a key activity that the team will be engaged in, as well as making sure that it is solid and thorough. And part of our user acceptance testing, which Kevin referred to, is not only making sure that the systems are working well, but making sure that the training is ready for our users as well. So big key activity, I think, for making sure that we're successful. As Kevin mentioned, things have been going pretty well in a hybrid environment, but I think this next phase, as we move into training, it will be kind of stressing that approach and making sure that it's going to work well. I think it's a big challenge for us, and so we have a lot of conversations about that and making sure that it can be done well.
Was the consideration, as supportive of the hybrid model, but was there a consideration of having those in person?
I think we will do some of, it depends on the training class. I think there's gonna be a mix. Some will need to be on site in person. I think especially for our technical people, we definitely know that there's, and we already have some groups like our new AMI technology group, they're already in regular on-site training that they participate in. Other groups where there's maybe a lighter touch in terms of process change or systems change, will probably back off and not make that a full requirement. So we're trying to evaluate each particular class, each particular group to see what might be most effective.
I can see it.
Yeah. Another key aspect, I think, to the success of the program is making sure that more broadly our internal employees, even those who may not be touched as much, but also our customers as well, understand where we're at in the program. And this is a key activity by our corporate communications department, Julie Cunningham's group. They have been doing a super job. We really, really appreciate their engagement
Since we've last met, they've been putting together, finalizing their deployment communication plans, so how we plan to get word out to our customers as we go. We've got our e-newsletter that went out in May. We continue to participate in John's Third Thursdays on a regular basis with some Q&A. And then we continue to update our FAQs, the frequently asked questions, for our call center reps so that they can appropriately address questions that come in from our customers by phone. We actually have seen a decline in those customer contacts coming in, so hoping that means that we're doing a good job communicating, but I would expect that to pick up more as we get closer and into deployment. Upcoming activities there, we will be doing more water deployments, so some of that is prep work and making sure that our boxes that the water meters sit in, we're planning on replacing some of those. And so as we get closer to work actually at customer sites, we'll be ramping up the communications that pertain to those customers and have something specific directed to them. Corporate Communications continues to build out website content on our snowplow.com website. And then we'll be developing the specific communications that are being planned in the plan that they have just developed. On the risk and challenges, I do want to point out I had in there envelopes and supply chain issues impacting customer communications. Julie did share with me after I had already submitted the slides for this that those are mitigated. So we'll be dropping that as a risk because we are in good shape now on those particular risks. Any questions on the training or internal external communications that I can answer?
Question about implementation.
Sure.
I don't think it's covered by the slide deck. So where are we planning to be ready when we go live with AMI to have new rates approved by the board for like with your car charging and the self-pay lined out, those kinds of things?
So that is kind of a parallel activity that would need to take place. That's not something the program team would be directly involved in. We're trying to make sure, though, that everything is set up and ready to go for that.
Right.
I think at that point, it's mostly just a resource balancing with labor, internal staff, on making sure that we have the right people ready to go. But the systems will be capable of handling that. We are running some tests with some sample rates and what a time of use rate would, how that would look going through the system.
Good.
All right, I will invite our HR team up to the podium at this point, and they are going to share some of the activities that we've been doing related to staffing.
Staffing. Hi, good morning. My name's Amanda Bowman. I'm a senior HR business partner here and primarily focusing on talent development. Thank you for this. I think what I really want to focus on here is no changes since we last met, no increase in new employee count. But really just focusing on phase one, 2021, we met some of the goals that we had with internal staffing, placing some promotions internally in some of the PMI tech manager positions, some HR generalist, position, IT analyst position, to name a few. Phase two in 2022, we're closing out some of the positions that we had. Tim just recently mentioned that we have some of the water meter rollout that we have been planning for. And so we have a water distribution specialist time limited position that we've just filled. We have three more coming up in phase three of 2023. So that's something that we're looking forward to and that had been planned. So 2023, more of the same of just the staffing levels that we talked about before. And then 2024, maintaining those staffing levels. Really, that will be a lot of those technician exchange meter reader or the meter exchangers that Kevin talked about. What we might see is a little bit of turnover in those roles, and we're expecting that because they are time limited roles. So 2024 will be a lot of support from an HR perspective on just making sure that we have a pipeline full. And talk a little bit more, Angie will talk a little bit more about how we're developing those community partnerships, building out those relationships. So we have ways in our community to find, I'd say, creative solutions to find staffing. And then 2025 offboarding as applicable. So I think that's really important to speak to something that Commissioner Olson has talked about, is we're not keeping everybody on staff. This is something that, this is a project, we'll staff up as needed, and then we'll offboard as needed as well. So that's something that I wanted to make sure that we addressed. Any questions on this slide?
You know, Amanda, I saw on social media recently we had posted some time-limited positions. I can't remember what they were for with the PUD. I'm curious, do we know how that's going as far as getting applications and getting a good pool?
Not aware of what those particular positions are.
Okay.
We tend to be fairly successful that even if they're time limited positions,
yeah,
because people feel excited about working at Osage County PUD to get their foot in the door at a minimum.
Yeah.
And
I agree. Thank
yeah.
you.
Good question. And then really this slide I want to share speaks to our internal partnerships for this project from an HR perspective. We're working really closely with our Connect Up team, with our meter readers and meter reading management, closely with our water department partners, Brant and team, customer service management, legal, obviously our IBEW partners. There's a lot of work that we're meeting with them regularly, and our business readiness team. So just a lot of people to make sure that we're not only staffing appropriately, but there's a lot of various, I would say, internal communications to make sure that everyone's feeling comfortable and confident that we have the plan in place moving forward. As there's a lot of change happening, and managing that change in some aspects is what Tim spoke to, but I think a lot, some of it is also from the employee experience perspective, and how can we help employees, and it's going out and meeting the people where they are. Commissioner Olson, do you have a question?
I can think of one if you
want. Sure. I'll turn it over to Angie Michelson.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Angie Michelson. I work in our talent development area of our HR department. And Amanda talked about our internal partnerships, and this is a list of our some of the organizations that we partner with out in the community. And we actually had an opportunity a couple weeks ago to attend a workforce partner roundtable event in Everett, and a lot of these organizations were in attendance, so it was a great opportunity for us to meet them and put faces and names together so we can continue to connect with them to, as Amanda talked about, for future workforce opportunities. Some other ways that we're connecting with the community is through our local career fairs. And so far in 2022, our recruiting and talent development teams have attended 23 career fairs locally in the community. And the next slide is about our meter reader retention. I'm actually really excited to talk about some things that we're doing, but wanna, back in 2021, we had our initial meeting with the meter readers, and they were presented with materials and next steps. One of the opportunities they were presented with was to take a career planning course through Everett Community College, and we had 9 meter readers take advantage of that opportunity. And then throughout 2022, we're just continuing to engage with our meter readers. So we attend their team meetings the third Thursday of each month. I will be there tomorrow to say hi and to answer any questions they might have. And then I'm working really closely with Wendy, who's the meter reader manager, and she's having one-on-ones with her employees to really find out what they're interested in and what they want to do in the future with Snohomish County QED. And through those one-on-ones, we have discovered that 8 of them are actually interested in our line department. So she's just yesterday reached out to our line training coordinator to see if we can get them in a flagger certification course so they can get their flagger cards. And then we also have 9 meter readers that are interested in other departments within the district. They include real estate, the warehouse, crew dispatch, and substation. So our next steps are to connect with those managers and see if we can arrange some job shadowing opportunities or ride along so they get a true day in the life of what they do and to see if they're still interested after they go out and meet with them. And then throughout 2023, we're just going to continue our efforts to find meter readers opportunities within the district. And then I just want to close by just mentioning that it's actually Meter Reader Appreciation Week this week. Yeah. So it's a great opportunity to say thank you and let them know how much we appreciate them. And if you don't have any questions, I'm going to give it to Kevin.
Thank you, meter readers. And whoever my meter reader is, the dog hasn't met him yet, so him or her.
I just think this looks like a careful dance between helping our meter readers go to the next position and keeping them in their position to continue to read the meters. So I'm curious how we're doing that. Are we sort of guaranteeing in positions after they don't need to read the meters anymore? Or how do we?
We're really encouraging them to start looking now. And if they find positions that they qualify for, might interview for, they're welcome to apply, and if they get hired now, that's great.
Okay.
And then you're right, there is that fine line. We need you, but we want you, we care about you, we want you to be successful.
Yeah.
So if it happens, and Amanda, if you can back me up on this, if we, if all of them find new opportunities before we're done with the project, I believe we'll hire time limited meter readers who, after the project is done, then we'll say thank you. And
hi, thank you for helping these people build their lives. I think it's great. I have a question about maybe, I don't know if you can answer this, but do they earn a living wage?
Yes, they do.
So I, Amanda Bowman again. So we have negotiated with the IBEW. These positions for the meter exchangers are represented positions. They are a little bit less than the meter readers make, but more than minimum wage, which is, and I want to say it was a little bit more than, was more than $20 an hour. I think it was like $21 or $22 an hour. That was where we're starting. And then this is something that we want to look at. We want to make sure that we're recruiting people who are able to allow for inflation. I mean, this is something that we've talked about, but we wanted to see what recruitment efforts looked like before we made a determination to make any changes. This is what our tentative agreement is with the IBEW at this point. It is a living wage, and it comes with certain benefits that they wouldn't maybe find elsewhere either. So, yes.
Good. That's great. Does that include some kind of insurance coverage or?
Yes, it does for, it's a bit of a carve out for this specific situation. That doesn't
sure.
always, it isn't necessarily what is in the collective bargaining agreement for typical time limited positions, but because this is an exception.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for your answers.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Olson, I just have a question. You were talking about, our current meter readers. I commend you on giving them the opportunity. So, and they have an interest, and they go to the next level if they have an interest when there is an opening in that due to retirement or wherever They're not, would not be in addition to?
Correct. They would only, they would be applying or bidding on open positions only. But we want them to kind of have eyes wide open.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the intent is, and it's something that we would need to bargain it. At some point, we want to make sure that we're not hiring the new regular full-time employees, then continuing to kind of create this the same meter reader situation. So we will be having, I think, when it makes sense, depending on schedule with when where the project is, time-limited positions only moving forward. Say, okay, well, then we'll just hire time-limited meter readers moving forward. So then those folks, like Angie had mentioned, will then, after we no longer need regular meter readers anymore when the AMI project is completed, then they'll be able to move on. So, but no additional FTEs. They're not, it's not just, oh, well, then you want to be a flagger, then we'll add a flagger.
Don't, for those who opt out, don't you need to?
We will have the plan, the project plan has a handful of meter readers that will still be there to read meters for opt outs. Absolutely.
Thank you.
There is that. Good question. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Angie. All right, so our final item we have today is, as we mentioned earlier, is our Z2 consultant contract amendment for. So Z2 Solutions, they've been on board with us since 2019, actually before that too, but primarily on this program since 2019. We feel they've been a great investment for us, have helped us to avoid a number of pitfalls because they've been down this road before with a number of other utilities and have really been great in coaching and guiding us along throughout this program. And so as we've done before, we're now preparing for the next phase of the program, the deployment phase. And so we wanted to add work for them to help support us during this phase. So this contract, history as far as the amendments. Previously, we've had Amendment 1 and an Amendment 2, and those added prior phases to the project, our procurement phase and our current implementation phase. And then we also had an Amendment 3, which was no cost change. It was just adding some scope around testing. And so really, this is piggybacking off of Amendment 1 and Amendment 2. And in the contract, we had a statement, the noted consultant will also provide ConnectUp program deployment phase consulting and technical support pending approval of deployment phase. Scope of work fees and schedule to be determined at a future date. So we're now at that date where we've put together amendment language. And so the key areas that they'll be helping us out with really high level is supporting our meter deployment lead and their team, help us out as we continue planning the deployment and helping providing support during the installations themselves. Also network coverage assessment as we complete the installation of those base stations. There will be some testing to make sure that no meters are left behind, that everything's covered there. And so they'll be helping us out with that aspect too. And then our systems validation, testing and acceptance, and ensuring that our systems performing not just during go live, but performing well days after, months after, years after we go live. And so the amendment summary, the cost for this portion of the amendment would be $2.1 million to support the remainder of our current implementation phase, which goes through June of 23, through the end of our deployment phase, which is scheduled to end September of 2025. For a new contract value of $5.635 million. This is already budgeted within our program budget. We had plans for this already. We're just kind of chunking it out the way it is right now. And this will be included in the December 6th, 2022 consent agenda. One of the great things about this contract is it is time and materials and is as directed by the project and program leaders. So as we need help with things, then we ask Z2 to work on those, okay. And then they'll work on them. And so probably won't be using the full $2.1 million, but it's just there in case we need it. So this will be coming up again in the next commission meeting. So if you have any questions about it now, or between now and then, we're available to answer questions on it.
Commissioner Walsh, do you have questions?
Could you just give a couple of examples of specific things that they do, the kinds of things that you need to have help with?
Sure. Yeah, so I think one of the, there's a lot of benefits. One of the great benefits is they help provide some flex support for us. So if we're short on maybe some testing leads, some program or project management help, if we need more bandwidth, for example, they're able to provide very quickly that the headcount for that. One of the great things they do is we always do like a 6-month look ahead with them. And so they take all their experience from prior projects with other utilities and say, okay, this is what we saw based on where you are right now. This is what you should expect to see. Here are the things you should be planning out. And then we take those items, integrate them into our project plans, our project schedules, and then communicate them out and ensure that they're worked by the team. So it's great to have that kind of that vision into the future of what we need to be doing rather than discovering it along the way and having to redo things. Does that help answer your question, Commissioner Wolf?
Well, that was a great general answer, but I was just trying to think maybe a little more specifically than that. What would be something you would run into and you'd say, oh, we need to call Z2 or we need to get them to come in? And one thing you said was to kind of give you relief or when you need time off. Or, I mean, I didn't quite understand that, but.
Since the program project teams are quite busy, sometimes we don't have enough time for all of the work that we have. And so we're able to lean on them because they have project management experience, they have system integration experience, they have testing experience. So people in those various roles, if we need more dedicated time to those, we're able to lean on them to help out instead of having to go out and hire new people or temporary people to do that work. They're able to help out. So that's kind of, being partners with us, but also leaders, as I mentioned, and being able to look ahead. One specific thing that we're having them do is a business go live plan. And so they're helping us identify what are all the things the business needs to do in preparation for our go live. It's hard for us to imagine, since we haven't gone through that experience yet, everything that needs to take place. And so they've written out a very detailed 20-page plan on all the things that the business needs to do to prepare for go live, what to expect during go live, and then steps to take after go live to continue to support the work going forward.
So do they do most of their work with us remotely or on the ground with real people?
Yeah, most of their work is remotely, yes. They're pretty much hybrid. They're here about once every 6 months, I would say. We haven't, with the hybrid approach in the program, it's worked pretty well for them to stay remote, not to have to burn through travel expenses.
The utility.
Okay.
Yeah, the utility.
A hybrid, right. Does save us a lot of money, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So essentially,
all right, thank you for that.
Have made the learnings over the years as other utilities have gone through this, and we're sort of late in this and bring all that expertise to us to help. We'll be experts when we're done.
We hope so. We hope so. Yeah, it's been interesting as we bump into other utilities that have implemented AMI. We bring up Z2 Solutions, bring up John Wamba's name and others,
And there's a kind of a little light in their eye, and they're like, oh yeah, you guys are lucky. Lucky to have him, because they are well known throughout the industry. So we were very fortunate to have this team. And we're, you know, we were, Tim and I were a little nervous, I think, you know, a year or two ago, like, I hope we can keep them on this whole time. They're not, but they've been very dedicated to us. They do have other work that they do, but they never seem, they always have all the time that we need for them. They're always available for us.
Good.
Okay, well then.
Any other questions, commissioners? Do you have anything?
No, I have no more. Thank you.
Okay, so just wrapping up, just next steps, Z2 Amendment 4, December 6th consent agenda. Our Aclara contract amendment, Travis Olson will be bringing, we're thinking it's going to be January 23 commission. We still have to finalize the timing for that. But that will be that probably 10 to 15% amendment for the Aclara contract for the longer duration that they'll be involved in the program. And our next commission quarterly update will be March of 23. There will be no, we originally had a December 23 plan, but since we moved this one out to November, we don't have plans to conduct that one. So next time we'll be here for the update will be in March. And then as far as program, you know, we've talked about these items. We'll continue to build out our base stations, continue our systems integration testing, start up our UAT testing, and continue to monitor our meter delivery forecast in the first quarter, getting hopefully a much clearer idea of the delivery of meters during the latter part of second quarter of 23. So our final slide, any questions?
Well, I think we've
got
the
counsel, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Guy, do we have any other items this morning?
No, that's the end of our GM manager reading study session. Thank you.
Well, it's 11:54 a.m., and this meeting is being recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene in this commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.